We're now learning from you about a facet of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, a man who terrorized this nation for 17 years with bombs, killing people and maiming people.
Just intuitive terror that I felt, just where the hair on the back of your neck stands up and you know that something isn't right.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer, producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And Francie is unfortunately not here today. Yes, I know you'll have to dry your eyes, Matt. But yeah, Francie is, man, she's off doing a very exciting, very important, very cool project. And you'll hear about it soon, but we can't really disclose what it is at this point. But we do have an extremely special guest and a friend of mine.
Hello, I'm Jamie Gearing, author of Madman in the Woods, Life Next Door to the Unabomber.
How you doing, Jamie? It's good to see you again.
Great, and really great to see you as well. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, you and I met a while back. When we were doing a project for Audible about some guy named the Unabomber. I don't know, some clown.
Some guy named Ted, yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
some guy named Ted. And, you know, we connected and we interviewed you for the project, which was called Where the Devil Belongs. And it's on Audible and it's a great series and it goes really in depth with interviews of the people who knew Kaczynski, like yourself, and the people who were victimized by him, which they were all extraordinary people, and also the investigators who investigated and eventually locked him up. So it's so great to have you here to talk about your new book. So tell me, when you decided to write a book about your infamous next door neighbor.
So since Ted Kaczynski's arrest in 1996, I mean, I was only 16 when he was arrested, but I have always wanted to write this book. And in 2017, I started to get serious about it. I started to outline, I started to write down my own memories. And then in 2018, as I was writing, I was approached by a production company who did a documentary that ended up being on Netflix called Unabomber in His Own Words. And as I was telling the producers my stories and my memories from childhood, they kept saying, you have to finish this book. You have to tell your story. It is so incredible. This perspective has really never been shown before. Growing up next to a serial killer, the childhood memories, the fondness that you felt towards him and how that changed through the years. It's such an interesting perspective and you have to finish. And so they really did, you know, inspire and prompt me, and they're huge supporters of the book now as well, just like you, Jim. And so I just completely dedicated myself to finishing it and getting it published. And here we are.
So one of the things that you mentioned though was your fondness for him as a kid. And obviously, as you said, that changed over time. Why would you be fond of him as a kid? What was it that made you fond of your next door neighbor?
So, you know, I write about this in the book, and it's still unclear to me if Ted Kaczynski really you know, was being kind and neighborly in those early years, or if it was just part of his methodical cover, really, you know, trying to portray himself as this normal next door neighbor. But when I was little, about 4 years old, this is the first memory that I have of Ted, is he came over to my house and he brought me a gift. He had hand painted some rocks for me. And I was so excited. And, you know, it was very kind of him. It was thoughtful. And I wasn't scared of him in those very early years. I thought he was strange. He looked very odd. He smelled odd. You know, he was the man of the mountains that lived next door, but he was just Ted, or, you know, we referred to him sometimes as Teddy. And when I was a baby, of course, I don't remember this, but he would come to our home for dinner. He held me as a baby. My own mother remembers him as being very kind and shy, even very reserved. And, you know, again, as the years progressed, for obvious reasons, he was right in the middle of his campaign of terror. He did become much more frightening. His visits definitely had changed. And, you know, he would come knock on our door and ask what time it was, even what day it was. And if I was home alone and my parents were down at the mill, which was close, but not close enough, I would hide. I would hide in the closet. I was terrified of him.
Right. So Ted bought some land that was in a corner of your property, right?
Yes. So my grandfather had purchased a ranch in 1948 with about 9,000 acres. And in 1971, he had decided to sell a parcel of his land, 1.4 acre, and he ended up selling it to none other than Ted Kaczynski and David Kaczynski. And so from 1971 until 1996, Ted was our neighbor, and our family's ranch land surrounded his property.
So why that particular piece of land? Why did your grandfather decide to sell that parcel versus something way out on a corner somewhere?
So that specific parcel was not needed for his ranching operations. It was kind of on the edge of his ranch land. And it was just, he was in need of a little bit of cash, and it was an easy piece to subdivide and sell.
Got it. And how far was this from where your house was built? You lived in a log cabin, right?
Yes. So my parents built their log cabin late 70s, early 80s. And the cabin, our cabin, was just less than a quarter mile from Ted Kaczynski's plot of land. Mm. And at the time that he was building, it was even more isolated and rural. There was hardly anybody out there. And I'm sure that was appealing because that was the lifestyle he was looking
right.
for.
And when you lived there, like, was it, was your childhood pretty lonely? I mean, did you get to have friends? It didn't seem like you have, if you're on a 9,000 acre ranch, doesn't seem like you have a lot of nearby next door neighbors.
Yes, there aren't very many. And we were close to 4 miles away from town, as we call it. When I say town, it's Lincoln, Montana, tiny town of approximately 1,000 residents. I mean, the school is kindergarten through high school. There was like 12 people in my class. I mean, it is teeny tiny. Luckily for me, I had cousins that were close to my age, and so they were my best friends. Otherwise, I think I would have been even more lonely. But, you know, that I think that does play into why I felt that fondness for Ted as well, because it was kind of lonely being out there. I mean, I had the cats, and I had, you know, some imaginary friends as a really little kid. And, you know, seeing somebody was exciting. And so that probably is part of those like endearing feelings that I felt towards our strange neighbor in those early years.
Got it. And so as you're writing the book and as you're being interviewed for Where the Devil Belongs that we did together. Obviously, this brings up some nice memories of your childhood. And even though you may not have had a lot of neighbors, you really enjoyed yourself there in the middle of nature, and your parents must have, because they chose that as a place to raise you. What is it like sort of reliving that in such great detail?
So that part of it, writing about my childhood and that just the ability to escape into nature and, you know, an opportunity that many are not afforded, was really an incredible part of writing this. And, you know, reliving the memories of my late father, you know, horseback riding, being on an isolated mountain lake, and all of those things were really beautiful. And as I was writing, you know, those particular scenes and reliving that part of my childhood, that question really did come up in the theme of my book. So, you know, how could these woods nurture and inspire me so much in such a beautiful way and darken my neighbor so much, you know, that the isolation particularly?
Well, perhaps your neighbor was a little dark to begin with. That might be have something to do with, but we'll get back to that later.
Yes.
So your first memories of him when he gave you these painted rocks, and didn't he give you a doll one time too?
He gave me, I'm told that he gave me a tea set, and that he also actually hand carved a cup for me, a wooden cup when I was a baby. You know, kind of as a baby gift, I suppose.
Interesting, because hand-carved wooden things became very important to the Unabomber investigation, didn't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, just the juxtaposition of, again, those same hands that methodically created bombs also were, you know, hand carving this beautiful gift made for me. I mean, again, it's just going through this, it's such a theme, is, you know, the different chasms of this killer.
Right. Well, and I think that's a really important thing. And this is something that I try to get people to understand in my work as a behavioral analyst, is that labels that we put on people sometimes actually help us miss the offenders that are right in front of us. In other words, you mentioned earlier when we were talking offline about a particular child sex offender, and you called them a predator. And a lot of people do call them predators. The only problem is that most of those people who call them predators see predators as lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. But in fact, many of them, and the ones that are good and skilled at grooming, not only grooming their targeted victims, but parents and guardians and the entire community, those people are able to throw everybody off their scent by acting like good people. And it's really important for people to know that human beings have multiple facets. We're now learning from you about a facet of Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, a man who terrorized this nation for 17 years with bombs, killing people and maiming people, extraordinary people, wonderful people who were trying to do wonderful things for the human race. And he tried to kill them. But at the same time, he could do something, quote, sweet and kind to a little girl who lived just next door. Now, that just really puts an exclamation point on the fact that people have multiple facets to them. And you can't put any person in one particular pigeonhole, because, you know, every person was a child at some point, it was a son or a daughter. And many of them are fathers and brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and cousins, and they have relationships. And if we label people with monster and predator words, then we're not going to be looking for the ones that are right in front of us, smiling in our face. And as you said, you're not sure whether Ted's interactions with you and your family were part of a cover-up of what he was really doing, or whether he actually had some good human emotions. I mean, you know, there are stories from his mother about, you know, nice things, but there's also stories about him being completely detached after he went in the hospital when he was a baby and coming back and just not wanting to be held and doing nasty things to her, like pulling out the chair from under her when she was trying to walk to sit down at the table with a pot roast in a hot tray, and, you know, things like that. So there were seemingly very nasty things that he did, but you're also giving us the perspective of some nice things that he did. So go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that. Jim, you're 100% correct. And it's funny, I just read a quote from Carrie Rawson, BTK's daughter, and she had said something like, you know, maybe part of the reason that we're not catching serial killers as quickly as we should is because they're very capable of blending in and looking normal. And you're right, we're looking for these monsters, but many times they're your neighbor, they're a father, they're a grandfather, they're seemingly normal people. And of course, Ted was very eccentric and strange, but he was living this perceived peaceful, off-grid lifestyle.
Right.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And, you know, and it's a valuable lesson, both of those lessons, what BTK's daughter said and what you have saying about Kaczynski, they're true. And, you know, I know that his brother, you know, had very strong love and loving feelings for Ted. But at the same time, he at some point really thought that Ted might be the bad guy, and he turned him in. But he turned him in thinking that it was going to rule him out. There were something like 1,200 and or 1,400 other suspects that were also turned in at the same time. So he was not alone.
Yeah. When he did. You know, end up contacting the FBI, knew that there was basically a 50-50 chance that Ted was the Unabomber. And so I just can't imagine, really, and especially knowing David now, how difficult that decision had to be, knowing how much he loved his brother and still loves his brother, having to face something like that.
Right. Well, you know, it's understandable, but I know that because of, you know, the investigators who he interacted with, how many times, and his lawyer as well, I also talked to his lawyer, how many times they sort of had to go back and get more and more and more information. And each time, David was hoping that this is going to rule him out. This is going to rule him out, but it didn't. It actually eventually ruled him in, with the work of supervisory special agent James Fitzgerald and forensic linguistic profiling. But there came a time at some point that your feelings towards your next door neighbor started to change. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, as mentioned, you know, in the 90s, early 90s, when Ted would come to the home, I would start to really be fearful of him. And it was probably a combination of me understanding more of the world around me, and then also just him specifically. So his cadence changed. He was more task driven. His appearance had changed. I mean, his clothing was more torn and tattered and soot on his face and more emaciated looking. So his appearance had changed. His, you know, like I said, his cadence had changed. And, you know, I would hide and wait until he would finally leave. And then as he would walk over the hill back to his cabin, I would peer through my bedroom window just to make sure he was really disappearing. He was really leaving. And then, you know, later on, many times as a teen, I would take walks in the woods by myself. And the summer prior to Ted's arrest, him and I actually almost collided in the woods. And both of us, being alone, were shocked to see another person. But that was the first time I remember really being terrified. And again, I'm a young woman in the middle of the woods by myself with a stranger. I mean, that was just, you know, that could be alarming, but it was more than that. It was this just intuitive terror that I felt, just where the hair on the back of your neck stands up and you know that something isn't right. And, you know, so we said hello to each other, as normal as I could possibly be, and turned around, both of us going our opposite ways. And I ran home that day. I mean, looking over my shoulder the entire time, making sure that he wasn't behind me.
So this chance meeting in the woods, this was a year before he was actually arrested.
Yes.
So that's 16 years into this bombing campaign. So that's, you know, he has killed a number of people. You actually, as a teenage girl, almost ran into a serial killer in the middle of the woods. I mean, when you think about it in terms of what he was actually doing, that's a really scary prospect.
It is really scary. And, you know, not only is he at the height of his reign of terror, you're right, he's been killing and maiming for years, writing in his journals of these innocent people, calling them experiments, and he's completely isolated. It's really scary to think about that. And then to know as well what he was doing in those woods. He was many times testing bombs. And, you know, I just think back, like, what if I would have come up to him in those woods when he was doing something like that? I mean, the scenario could have been much different, but, you know, again, it was lucky for me that it was so close to home.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned it, being in the woods and, you know, what he might have done if he was testing it. Did you ever hear bangs or bombs going off or anything like that?
Yes. My father and I would definitely hear loud booms, bangs in the woods, but it was so muffled by the pines that it was difficult to truly discern. Uh-huh. And I thought maybe it was gunshot. But my dad was like, no, I think it's something different. But then we would, you know, stand and be completely stoic and quiet and try to listen for another one, and it wouldn't come.
Right. Which, in fact, is actually a greater indication that it's a bomb and not hunting. So that's crazy. That's hard. That's really difficult to, you know, discern. You know, I know that he had another cabin hidden up somewhere else into the woods and had some bomb materials there. And he probably tested them far away from his cabin so that it would be difficult to figure out.
Yeah, but he did. He had another cabin in McClellan Gulch, which was about a mile away from our home. So to hear, you know, something happening that far away with all the pines is pretty difficult.
Yeah. And he also hunted for his own food, right?
Yes, he did.
And there was an incident regarding him and that hunting rifle, wasn't there?
Yes, there was another example, I suppose, of terror in our own backyard that, you know, I had heard little snippets of this story after Ted was arrested, but it wasn't really until writing Mad Men in the Woods that I really got to the complete truth of it. And there was a day that my little sister and my stepmom were in our woods on our property, and they were reseeding some ground. My little sister was 2 at the time, so that would have been 95, again, right before Ted Kaczynski's arrest. And while they were in the woods doing their chores, my stepmother felt a presence. She felt something in the woods that it was, you know, it felt stealth. It felt ominous. She felt danger. And she thought it was potentially a mountain lion. They're in the middle of rural Montana. That's definitely a possibility. And she knew something wasn't right. So she grabbed my little sister and threw in the truck, and they left. And she didn't really give much more thought to that day until after Kaczynski's arrest. She was able to read some of the journals that were found in Ted's home. And in one of those journals, Ted is actually recounting that day they shared in the woods. Huh. And he
shared isn't a unique way of saying it, but go ahead.
Well, I guess when I say share, I feel like he was always in his journals seemingly writing to an audience. And so I suppose that's what I mean by shared. But yes, he was writing in his journal about that day and how he was looking at my stepmother and my little sister through the scope of his rifle and going back between mother and daughter. And he writes that it would be easy to take the little bitch out, but then the big bitch could get away. Or if I shoot the big bitch, then the little bitch would be left on the hill. And it was the first time that I realized how much danger we were in. Mm.
Yeah, because, and it would have been innocent on your part and part of your family members, but boy, if you stumbled onto something that could have exposed him as the Unabomber, serial killer, the 17-year terrorist in the United States. He could have been extremely violent with you. And I'm so glad that didn't happen with any of your family members or yourself.
Yeah. And Jim, honestly, I mean, that was a very difficult thing to write about. And, but it wasn't the only thing that that I found while writing this book. And there were many other examples of terror in our own backyard that just felt really, really brazen.
Yeah,
honestly.
Well, and that's why our listeners should definitely get your book. And what I hear, you actually narrated the Audible version, the audiobook.
I did. I did just finish the narration for Madman in the Woods, Life Next Door to the Unabomber, available on Audible, which was a really interesting experience. I actually had to try out to narrate it, yeah. But clearly I got the part.
That's awesome.
And yeah, it's really great. So it's available now for pre-order on Audible.
That's cool. Well, and when will that be available? When will that be coming out?
April 19th.
Okay. And the hardcover book, the hard copy?
The hardcover is also available April 19th.
Okay, great. Well, what's really great is that you've also offered to send one of our listeners an autographed copy of your book.
I would love to send one of your listeners an autographed copy. They are beautiful. I just received them. I have the art here. So this is the paperback. So just envision so much prettier. But yes, I am happy to share a autographed hardcover.
Well, that's really kind of you. And we'll set it up. We'll have some kind of a drawing for our listeners and Patreon subscribers to see who gets to win your copy of the book.
That's wonderful. Awesome.
And they should definitely also listen to Where the Devil Belongs, which is about the FBI's investigation for 17 years of the Unabomber. And you'll meet some other extraordinary people. And I'm telling you, it was an amazing educational journey for me, even though I was in the FBI at the time and good friends with Jim Fitzgerald, who was profiling the case. And actually, we discussed a lot of the case elements during the time of the investigation. But I still learned so much more while I was doing this really amazing documentary series that also featured our guest, Jamie Gehring, and her experiences with the Unabomber, living next door to the Unabomber. And I hope that everyone will get her book and either listen to it or buy a hard copy of it and listen to the Where the Devil Belongs, the audio documentary series about it, because the details that we go into or just, you can't find them anywhere else. And the perspective that you have of this incredibly prolific serial bomber, serial killer, well, nobody else has that perspective in the world. So thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for allowing me to share it as well with your listeners.
And I'm sure Francie, if she was here, not only would she have interrupted you 100 times, but she would have actually told you how, you know, proud she is that you are able to come forward and talk about this story, because it's important. And, you know, the more we turn these kinds of offenders into evil monsters, the harder they are to catch, because that makes them have some kind of power above and beyond us. And they're not. They're human beings, all of them. And we need to look at them that way and understand that their humanity is a given, but it's also a way to understand them and find them and catch them and stop them from doing what they're doing. So
I agree. And I love that you're saying that, because, you know, again, as I was writing, I found myself personally, someone who has lived true crime and experienced a serial killer, really having a hard time with the fact that he was so similar to us and seeing his humanity in so many different places. So I think that we are very conditioned to look for the monster, and it's important not to.
Right. Exactly. So thank you for giving us that very valuable perspective, and we appreciate it. We wish you so much luck on your book, and I hope that we get to do other projects together in the future.
Absolutely. Yes. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Jamie, and you know, have a great day, and we'll be seeing you sometime soon. And to our listeners, thank you for listening and watching. This is Best Case, Worst Case, signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gerbel. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D, the number 2, L.org.